I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Tomorrow at this hour, the 438th session of the Maryland General Assembly begins. Today, a preview. Baltimore City is certainly on the agenda. Governor Larry Hogan announced a plan to appoint an investigator to monitor management of the Baltimore City schools. This comes after the announcement of $2.5 million in emergency funding to restore heating to many of the district's aging buildings. The new federal tax overhaul could mean more revenue for the state. How to spend it is a point of contention. Democrats say they've got enough votes to pass their version of paid sick leave. And after threatening to take a knee, the Legislative Black Caucus is confident that their bill to increase diversity in the medical pot industry will pass. Rachel Bay covers Maryland politics for WIPR. Aaron Cox is the Baltimore Sun's State House Bureau Chief. They join me right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, on this balmy Tuesday afternoon. It actually got above 30. We're in the 40s. So everybody, you know, put on your shorts and T-shirts and flip-flops and enjoy the weather. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. Tomorrow is the second Wednesday of the new year. And that means that Maryland legislators will do their constitutional duty and convene in Annapolis for the opening of the 2018 General Assembly. As always, legislators have a number of hot-button issues to consider. After threatening to, quote, take a knee on various legislative initiatives put forth by the Democratic leadership, the Legislative Black Caucus leaders expect lawmakers to quickly pass a bill calling for more minority representation in the medical marijuana industry. That bill failed to pass at the very end of last year's session. Some Marylanders could pay higher state taxes because of the federal tax overhaul. Governor Larry Hogan has vowed action, as have Democrats. The governor also called on lawmakers to pass a bill that will allow women who have been raped to restrict parental rights from their attackers. Democrats are confident that they have the votes to override the governor's veto of their version of a paid sick leave bill. Legislators are also expected to turn their attention to Baltimore City to come up with a solution to address the city's staggering homicide rate. And just yesterday, the governor announced he will introduce emergency legislation to deal with problems in Baltimore City schools. And all of it will unfold in the shadow of the 2018 elections. As of today, seven Democrats have announced their intention to seek the nomination of their party to oppose Hogan next November. And a number of state senators, including some who hold powerful committee chairmanships, are facing primary and general election opponents. Everybody is up for re-election this year, and that can't help but inform what's going to happen in the session. So joining me with a preview of the 2018 General Assembly, two experienced reporters who will be in the thick of it for the next 90 days. Rachel Bay covers Annapolis politics for WIPR, and Aaron Cox is the Baltimore Sun's State House Bureau Chief. Welcome back to both of you. It's good to see you and Happy New Year. And Aaron, you're on the phone with us from Annapolis. Happy New Year to you as well.
Oh, thank you so much.
So, Aaron, let's start with you. This federal tax overhaul, the Republicans pushed it through right before Christmas, and it's going to have all sorts of consequences that people are just figuring out. But explain to us how it is that Governor Hogan and several other people appear to think that it's going to result in a big revenue boost for the state of Maryland. How does that work?
So the way that it works is Maryland's tax code is built off of the federal tax code. So there's all sorts of ways in which they're coupled together. So you make a change at the federal system, they trickle down to Maryland. And so one of the primary ways that this could really increase Maryland tax bills is that there's a whole number of exemptions in Maryland tax law, all sorts of benefits that you can take and you can claim to reduce your tax bill. But you can only take them if you have taken them first at the federal level. They no longer exist at the federal level. So there's no way to take them in Maryland. So as a result, your tax bill is going to go up. Another example here is that they're doubling the standard deduction on the federal level. So people who may use to itemize their taxes would instead be in a better financial place or have a lower tax bill with the IRS if they instead take this higher deduction at the federal level. In Maryland, you can only itemize your taxes if you've also itemized them at the federal level. So that means people who, although it may be advantageous of them and to lower their federal tax bill by taking the standard deduction, they actually end up with a lot higher tax bill in Maryland if they don't itemize here. So those are just two of the ways that, there's kind of this coupling where Maryland's system is built on the federal system. And both of those ways would prompt anywhere from $100 million to $450 million a year in higher tax bills for residents.
And Rachel Bay, obviously when we're talking about that kind of money, there's two issues here. One is, and the governor has mentioned perhaps some legislative fixes to see that Maryland residents' actual taxes don't go up between the federal and the state returns. So to perhaps changing the laws about what you can itemize and what you can't. And then, of course, the other issue is how to spend this money if, in fact, a windfall of that kind of at that level occurs, and I shouldn't perhaps call it a windfall, but I mean, it's revenue that hadn't been anticipated before this tax bill. So on the first side of the legislative fix side, do you hear much talk about simply trying to change the Maryland tax code to, if you will, decouple it from the federal tax code?
So at this point, it's not completely clear how or this, I guess, the specifics of what the legislation would look like doing that. The governor has said that he wants to put the money back in the pockets of Maryland taxpayers, but he hasn't offered specific ways that he plans to do that. And the Democratic leadership also is saying, well, we want to hear what the governor is proposing and kind of go from there. I have heard from the leadership that while they do want to alleviate the burden on Maryland taxpayers, and they do talk about kind of how hard hit Maryland taxpayers are going to be as a result of this federal tax change, they also talk about the fact that there are a lot of underfunded programs. And the example that the speaker gave me was the Children's Health Insurance Program, which the federal government is expected to cut funding for.
Yeah, it expired completely last September, at the end of last September, and it hasn't been renewed. And when it does get renewed, almost nobody expects it will be renewed at the level it was before.
Yes, exactly. And the speaker said, well, that kind of a program might be a great beneficiary of some of this extra revenue that we weren't expecting to get.
So, Aaron, you know, when it comes to those kinds of conversations, okay, if this extra revenue is here, we could, you know, the governor's his first reaction is let's give some sort of rebate or some sort of mechanism wherein that money goes back to Maryland taxpayers. And then Democrats, almost true to form, I mean, some would say it's almost a stereotypical reaction to say, well, let's figure out programs we can spend it on. It's an election year. Everybody's got to run for re-election, including the governor. How do you think that's going to play into people's decisions and people's votes about what to do with this money if, in fact, it ends up being at the levels that people are suggesting? $450 million is a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, I think that election year politics and election year considerations are going to be to permeate this entire discussion. I mean, you have Larry Hogan saying, hey, I'm not going to raise your taxes. That's a crucial part of his brand. That's a crucial part of his message. It's hard to see how he's going to be able to have any wiggle room on that and go back to his voters and his base and say, you know, but I really, I made an exception. And if he does make an exception, he has to have a really good story about why he made that exception. And the other piece of this that we haven't mentioned yet is that Donald Trump and congressional Republicans are also coloring all of this debate. We would not be having this discussion but for Donald Trump's election last year. And so Larry Hogan has been pushed by the Democratic Party, by Democrats hoping to challenge him for the governorship to really kind of stand up for Trump. And so him giving back all of this money, him pushing for legislation that makes sure that he's holding Maryland taxpayers harmless from an increase in their state income tax bills is a way for him to kind of say, look, see, I stood up to Trump. Look what I did. So there's not a ton of wiggle room for him there. On the other side of the aisle, you have Democrats, and Rachel mentioned the House Speaker as a really good example, saying we need to stand up and protect Maryland from the federal government and from Congress and from Trump, and it's going to cost us about $100 million a year to make sure these, I think it's 142,000 children, continue to have health insurance, and that is something we're going to continue to do. And that's the sort of talking point that that the Democratic electorate really wants to hear right now, the people, voters who really care about what's happening in Washington, which is kind of, you know, has a gravitational pull for people's attention in politics in Maryland at the moment, that those are the sorts of messages that help drive Democratic turnout. So everywhere you look, there's these little political landmines of how, of thinking about how this is going to play in my primary, how this is going to play come November, that are being taken in consideration as they try to figure out a solution.
Yeah, Mike Bush, Speaker of the House, said, you know, nobody is interested in not insuring 142,000 children. And it's interesting to me, Rachel Bay, that the governor even referred to this, to his plan to put the money back in the pockets of taxpayers, as he says, as his holiday gift to the people of Maryland, which is very Trumpian rhetorically.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And so it's interesting that, you know, on the one hand, he's trying to distance himself from Trump. On the other hand, he's embracing some of Trump's rhetorical devices. So that will be an interesting thing to see how it plays out. Rachel, paid sick leave. Lou Klippinger and others who've had a bill that was passed by the House and the Senate last year and then vetoed by the governor. The governor favors his own version of the bill. But it appears that Delegate Klippinger thinks that he's got the votes to override that veto and that that will be done in some somewhat short order when the session begins tomorrow.
Yeah, the legislative leaders have, Senate President Mike Miller and Speaker Bush have both said that they are confident they will override the veto of that particular bill. And one of, it's interesting, one of the components of the governor's bill that often gets talked about, even by some Democrats, as being kind of something that would be nice to have are these tax credits, to tax benefits and incentives to small businesses who do provide paid leave to their workers to kind of offset the financial burden of doing that. But when I've raised that with leadership, that they say, well, you know, that would be nice, but where are we going to get the money to do that? That they, I think Speaker Bush said that $100 million, you know, it's not money that we have lying around, and it's not necessarily something that we can afford to do.
And again, you know, because so many Marylanders, more Marylanders than in any other state in the country, itemize deductions on their federal and state returns, if fewer of those people are doing it, the impact of Maryland is going to be considerably more significant than it will be in many other states. Aaron Cox, the paid sick leave bill that the governor wants to introduce, assuming that the veto is overridden, as everybody expects it will be, does that make the governor's paid sick leave bill just dead in the water? And what happens? What's the next step for him at that point?
Well, it kind of depends on who you ask. The Democratic leadership kind of looked at his proposal, said, a day late, a dollar short, you never talked with us when we were developing this, you've kind of taken a my way or the highway approach, you can call it a compromise, but if you don't talk to us ahead of time and work out any sort of deal with us, this is not a compromise, we're not looking at that. We have a bill we like, we passed it before, we'll pass it again, moot point, dead on arrival. But when you talk to the governor's staff, and the governor, I believe, even said this at his press conference yesterday, that he thinks that there's some fundamental flaws with the bill that was passed, that he vetoed, that is about to be overridden. And his prediction is that once they override it, they're going to start fixing the problems that he has highlighted. And so from his perspective and from the GOP perspective, there is a flawed policy out there, and that even if the veto is overridden, the governor's proposal, if not taken up by itself as a replacement, would kind of provide a roadmap to fixing some of those problems.
Mm-hmm. So he'd be willing to work with the Democrats on the bill that exists, tweaking that bill rather than insisting that his entire package be reconsidered. Is that your understanding of it, Aaron? What do you think?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Governor Hogan has proven very deft at finding opportunities where he can present himself as bipartisan, even if you know, he didn't start out bipartisan, even if he kind of, you know, started the negotiations as my way or a highway, come to the point where he could say, look, now we've worked together. And, you know, when we talk about election year politics kind of coloring everything that happens down here, that this is another example of that, this gives him an opportunity to say, look, I worked with the Democrats. They had a bill. I didn't like it. I vetoed it. They overrode me. But look, now I have made it better than where we started because I'm a bipartisan governor.
Kumbaya, my lord. When we come back from a break, we'll sing all 12 verses. Ladies and gentlemen, Rachel Bay covers the State House for WYPR. Aaron Cox is the Annapolis Bureau Chief of the Baltimore Sun. We will have more after a break. 410-662-8780. That's our number if you'd like to be part of our conversation about what we can expect, what we'd like to see happen in the General Assembly, which begins tomorrow at noon. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Coming up tomorrow, nutrition diva Monica Reinagle is going to join me. We're going to talk about new approaches to weight loss with a behavioral economist, not the person you think to tap for weight loss suggestions off the top of your head. But we've got one who's going to give us his take on how we can approach this with our New Year's resolutions. We're also going to talk with Monica about the next generation of genetically modified food. So Monica Reinagle will take your calls and questions. That's coming up tomorrow on Smart Nutrition here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the 2018 Maryland General Assembly, which begins tomorrow. I'm joined by WYPR's Maryland politics reporter, Rachel Bay, and Aaron Cox, who's the State House Bureau Chief at the Baltimore Sun. We'd be happy to be joined by you as well. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Aaron Cox, the Baltimore City Schools had a rough week last week, terrible weather and terrible performance by some of the machinery in some of these very old buildings, and some would suggest terrible performance by some of the people running the school system, running the state procurement process, running how things happen here and the relationship between the state and the city. The governor had some things to say about that yesterday. He announced $2.5 million for the schools, and he proposed a new office, an office of an investigator to oversee what's going on in the school. So what did he have to say about those two items?
So we'll take the simple one first. He had been called upon by a lot of people to react in some way to the fact that you had Baltimore City School children huddled in classrooms, in parkas, in freezing temperatures, in schools that lack adequate heat and have lacked adequate heat for decades. And that, you know, that's clearly a systemic problem that took a long time to develop. And, you know, it is a sin committed by many people that we're in the situation that we're in now. And so the governor's response to that is to say, I'm going to go to this kind of disaster relief fund. I believe it's the same sort of fund used to help the Ellicott City Fund victims and, you know, say this is an emergency, and here's $2.5 million to help fix HVAC systems so that we do not have to cancel schools district-wide when we have a cold snap. Now, this money is money that he's not giving to the schools. The state's going to retain it. The Department of General Services is going to hire contractors to go and perform some of this work. So there's a lot of, politics involved there where, you know, where the governor is basically making a political statement that says he doesn't trust the schools to administer this. So he's going to have the state administer it instead. So this is kind of a short-term Band-aid fix. I mean, we're talking about a problem that's going to cost millions, tens of millions, if not more than $100 million to fix across the city. So, you know, $2.5 million is helpful and it's going to make a difference, but it's not going to solve the problem citywide. And the second thing that this kind of segues into is, you know, this idea of accountability, that K-12 education is one of the biggest expenses for the state of Maryland, $6 billion of its $43 billion budget, and it goes to K-12 education. And those are state tax dollars, and if you look at just state tax dollars, Maryland takes in about like $17 billion, $19 billion, so $6 billion out of that pool is a huge portion of the state's budget. And, you know, Larry Hogan made this point yesterday that there is very little accountability that the state can demand from the locals on how that money and whether that money is being spent wisely and whether the people in charge of Maryland schools are conducting themselves appropriately. So what he decided to do was create this investigative general position that would be housed in the State Department of Education. And this person would be able to independently investigate a huge swath of things, anything from procurement and contracting to school budgets to ethical violations to illegal conduct to just kind of like grade fixing graduation requirements. And he listed a number of controversies and scandals that have popped up in about a half a dozen districts in the state over the past 5 or 6 years as examples of the sort of thing that this state position could go investigate and then bring back to the Maryland State Board of Education its own fact-finding report about what is going on in the local schools.
And Rachel Bay, he did make note of, for example, conflict of interest issues that have come up in Baltimore County with the current and the former superintendent of Baltimore County Schools. He alluded to some test score shenanigans in Prince George's County. So he's not singling out Baltimore. But it's interesting that his immediate sort of visceral reaction to the problems in the schools is that it's caused the problems in Baltimore City schools having to do with heating and HVAC systems and boilers that are going kaput. His visceral reaction is that it has something to do with corruption. You know, that he's the people running the school system are just either inept or unethical. And he had the same kind of reaction to Mayor Pugh's crime plan a few weeks ago. You know, it's interesting the parallel that at least I've seen in this, where he says, you know, the mayor doesn't really have a crime plan, so I've got one, and here's my press release, my press conference to talk about it, a press conference where none of the city officials, the police commissioner, or the mayor, or anybody from any of those offices attended. I mean, do you think that this is a thinly veiled way of singling out the city of Baltimore, or is he really worried? He talked about a crisis of confidence in Maryland's public schools. Is he equating what's going on in other jurisdictions with what's going on in the city?
You know, it's hard to say exactly what he's equating in his head. I will say that there has been this tension between Baltimore's leadership and the governor, really since the previous mayoral administration, where there's almost the governor is very quick to kind of point fingers at the city's administration as the excuse for everything that possibly is going wrong in the city. And it's not a new thing. And it does, as you mentioned, span multiple issue points. It's hard to say why that's happening, I guess. I wouldn't want to pretend to get inside his head.
It is interesting that when he talks about crisis of confidence and that he's going to restore confidence by an investigator general or whatever he's going to call us. Aaron Cox, the Democrats, what's their initial reaction to the idea of this extra layer of monitoring being put in place at the State Board of Education?
I guess I'd collectively describe it as a shrug. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a pattern of behavior from the governor here, that he does aggressively go after Baltimore, but he has also aggressively gone after Baltimore County over air conditioning units there. It's no secret that, you know, Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz is among the more prominent Democrats hoping to unseat the governor. He's also gone after Prince George's County on a grade tampering and, graduation, rate scandal there. Also no secret that Prince George's County Executive Rashern Baker is another Democrat who is, hoping to unseat Larry Hogan. So it's not just Baltimore. There's these other jurisdictions, and whether they're because they're led by political opponents or whether because they happen to be some of the state's largest districts, Rachel, I have not had the privilege of being inside the governor's head. Um, But because of that, when Democrats are asked, what do you think about this idea? They say, well, of course, we want accountability. Nobody wants money to be spent irresponsibly. Maybe this is a good idea, but is it a genuine idea? Is he doing this? Is he proposing this for the reasons he stated, or is he proposing this in order to, you know, use a tool of state government to go after and dig up dirt on his political opponents? We don't know, but we're a little suspicious. So the Democratic reaction is, you know, nobody's going to come out and say the schools are perfect, nobody should look under any rocks, everything is fine. But on the other hand, they're quick to point out, you know, to question his motive.
Let's go to the phones. James in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Aaron Cox of the Baltimore Sun and Rachel Bay of WIPR.
Good afternoon. How you doing? And how's Miss Rachel doing?
Very good, thank you.
Yeah, I'm an education advocate, and I got the water shutoffs in Baltimore City schools and made them change curriculums because the studio curriculum they had that was didn't meet MSDE standards, along with a lot of other things. And I was reading.
You're talking about the water and the water fountains because the problem with the pipes. This predates the heating and
no, this is back in 2003. I got the water
shut
off.
Right.
Okay. But I've been advocating for an extremely long time, and I spoke at the board meeting concerning school budgets because we have a lot of vague titles and expenditures in these school budgets, and I personally would recommend that the governor audit the school system school by school, because what we found, and I have my own organization, what we found was there's a lot of expenditures on line items that were approved by Baltimore City's oversight and instructional leadership executive directors who make a lot of money, and these schools have money in them that shouldn't be spent on things other than children's education. And the governor, because the mayor ain't going to do it, the CEO ain't going to do it, the governor needs to have that commission, and I would like to be a member of it, because I realize that there's a lot of misappropriation, misuse, and vague things going on in these schools, and nobody is handling it to make the budgets more transparent, like I told Dr. Santa Lee's.
Okay, well, thanks for your call, James. Rachel, it's interesting. James brings up something that has come to the fore in this last 10 days, because when these problems with the school system happened initially, the mayor, Mayor Pugh's first reaction was, look, I don't run the schools, the state runs the schools. So we've got the state saying the city isn't running the schools well, the mayor of the city saying, look, the state has more control than they're admitting to. This is it's not my fault, it's your fault thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, no one is faster to point fingers. So it's interesting. One thing I've heard, so you do hear a lot from the city and from the city school system that this is a money issue, that they don't have the money to fix things like the heating system. When you talk to Republican legislators in Annapolis, they will often say, so first of all, Baltimore City receives more money per pupil than any other school system in the state. Now, of course, the money for the heating system, it's worth noting, comes from a different funding system.
Yeah, that's a capital expenditure. As opposed to operating. Uh-huh.
But to the caller's point a moment ago, the Republican legislators tend to point out that the administrative costs in city schools are very high, and that really what needs to be done, they say, and this is something I think the governor would probably agree with, is going into the city school system, into the city schools administration, and looking at where that money is being managed. And that's kind of where they say the crux of the problem really is.
All right, Aaron, one more question to you about education, what Rachel was just referring to in the governor's press release for when he announced this $2.5 million emergency funding for the HVAC and boiler systems. He alleges that the state's investment was more than 3.5 times the state average. That's in the city schools as opposed to other jurisdictions. Nearly twice the state average per pupil. Overall per pupil spending in the city is the fourth highest in the nation. And he contends that the city spends the most on administrative costs for the school system in America. Are those claims backed up by fact?
I'm still doing my homework on that. As he was saying them, I certainly raised an eyebrow, and I asked the governor's staff to provide me some detailed documentation about where he got those. I haven't finished going through all of that. It might be true. I just haven't verified whether or not it is yet.
All right, we're going to move to a couple of other topics, but first we want to go to the phones. Teddy in Hunt Valley, welcome to Midday with Rachel Bay and Aaron Cox.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking my call. Yep, this is Teddy the Tax Man. I'm the guy who gives the retirement and tax advice on Fox 45 Morning News, and I want to say kudos to Rachel, because I don't hear anybody bringing up the fact that the new tax legislation will definitely challenge, I guess I'll say, the state quite a bit. And I know the governor said, oh, you know what, I'm not going to raise taxes. But this is going to be challenging because, you know, in one respect, you look at the fact that, you know, that person who is itemizing on the federal return is going to itemize on the state return. I mean, that's just the law. That's just the law. So it's going to be interesting to see how all this works out.
And in your opinion, I mean, I take it you are an accountant. You are a tax preparer.
I'm an enrolled agent. An enrolled agent.
Do you think the idea of decoupling Maryland tax law from the federal tax law is a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, we don't know because. We don't know what's going to come in place of what they have now. You know, Rachel mentioned the fact that you can't itemize on your state unless you itemize on your federal. Well, if that person now doesn't have to itemize on the federal, probably his or her state taxes are going to go up. So I want to say that the Maryland legislature has its work cut out for it this year. Mm-hmm. I know they didn't pre-plan, if there's such a word, to talk about how the federal legislation affects the state legislation. But I want to tell you, they have just added, just by virtue of there being a new tax law, they have just added plenty to what they have to do beginning on tomorrow. Yeah. That's my comment.
Well, thank you for that comment, Teddy. I appreciate it. It is interesting. You know, one of the aspirational goals of the Republican tax plan was to simplify it. It sounds like for Maryland, many Maryland residents, it's going to be anything but simple, because you could find if you take the standard deduction on your federal return, that means you can't itemize deductions on your state return. That means your federal return, your tax liability goes down, but on your state return, it goes up. So then you have to figure out what's the worst case situation and how to get around it. So it is going to be complicated. Before we take a break, Aaron Cox, want to talk about medical marijuana. I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with some members of the Legislative Black Caucus. This was a number one priority for them, spreading the licenses around, having more minority or having any minority participation in this multi-billion dollar industry. Where does that stand? What's your guess on what will happen even in these first few days of the session?
So where that stands is the presiding officers have promised the Black Caucus they will take this up swiftly and they will get it done quickly. There's pretty much widespread consensus about how many more licenses should, and we're talking about growing licenses. There is diversity among some of the processors. There is diversity among some of the dispensary owners. But we're talking the people at the top of the supply chain, the people who are setting wholesale prices, the people there, and there's a very, very small number of them. There's only 14 that are licensed to grow right now. And so we're talking about getting more Black-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses into that section. And so there's a pretty wide consensus about how many more licenses, growing licenses, should be allowed, about the way that they would go about awarding them, about how a diversity study must be conducted in advance to determine to make sure that this sort of race-conscious license awarding passes constitutional muster. But it's not necessarily a done deal. And the chair of the Black Caucus, Cheryl Glenn, has said she wants it on the governor's desk by January 31st, which is just 3 short weeks after the session opens. That's very swift. And some members of the caucus, which represents 51 members of the General Assembly, so roughly about more than a third of the General Assembly are members of the caucus. Some of that big, powerful voting bloc have promised to be disruptors, and the term was take a knee if this isn't done swiftly, that they would block all other progress. And in a year when you're doing this messy tax code rewrite, you're trying to respond to the Trump administration, there's all of these other things that are happening. If the Black Caucus decides to impede progress starting in February, that could be a really dramatic moment.
How about, real quick, the impact of Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, and his directive to federal prosecutors to prosecute marijuana sales and processing under federal law? That's going to obviously throw a wrench into the works of many state marijuana industries.
Right. So that directive, that it's now up to the U.S. attorneys to decide what priority to give these drug prosecutions. Previously, they were told to deprioritize it. Now it's up to the individual U.S. attorneys to make that call. And so it's expected to have a much larger impact, and I believe it's the sixth state with legal recreation market. Those states with those markets, they have hundreds of millions of dollars of tax revenue pending on it. They are established. They have lots of jobs. Prosecutions there could cause ripple effects up and down the economy. In Maryland, the medical marijuana program, this is more of another layer of uncertainty. One of our cops reporters pointed this out. In a state where we have crime like we have in Baltimore, where we have drug problems and gang problems like we do in the state, it would be curious if the U.S. attorney decided to instead prioritize going after cancer patients in a state-sanctioned medical marijuana industry. But the bottom line is that we just don't know. And so this is an industry that's already very high risk. Banks won't insure you. It's usually all cash. You have to hire immense security. You have to hire armored trucks to move around your product and to move around your just like the cash that you use. And so for an industry that is just getting off the ground, that has already been beset by controversy and a lot of uncertainty, this just adds a whole nother layer of risk to getting into this market.
Curious indeed if the Attorney General or prosecutors start going after cancer patients. But as the saying goes in the famous story, things could get curiouser and curiouser as we move through this election season. Aaron Cox covers all things Annapolis for the Baltimore Sun. Rachel Bay covers the State House for WYPR. We'll have more on what's coming up in this year's General Assembly when we return. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. The 438th session of the Maryland General Assembly begins at noon tomorrow. If you've just joined us, we're talking with Aaron Cox, the Baltimore Sun's State House Bureau Chief, and Rachel Bay, who covers Annapolis for us here at WYPR. Democrats have had a veto-proof majority in the Maryland legislature for more than 100 years. Republican Governor Larry Hogan is one of the most popular governors in the country. He and all of the lawmakers are up for re-election this year, so all that happens in the session will occur in the shadow of those campaigns. You are welcome to join us with your questions and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We're going to move to some other topics. We do have an email here from Elaine, who said that, "I read that the city was forced to give back $66 million that was supposed to go to repairs of the city schools. So they had that money. What happened?" This is a report that Luke Broadwater had in the Baltimore Sun just a few days ago. Elaine, we are going to take up the issue of education in the Baltimore City Schools and the Baltimore City Schools capital funds and the repairs that are needed to these aging buildings on Thursday. So Thursday is going to be Education Day here at midday, and we will have an answer to that question for you. There's a whole lot of finger pointing going back and forth about whose fault it is, and the fact that the problems with the school buildings date back decades and decades. So we're going to have a full discussion about that on midday Thursday. But Aaron Cox, I want to ask you about, Rachel, let me direct this to you first, because you've both written about that, and that has to do with the sexual harassment policy in the General Assembly. The group of women legislators, it's frightening, actually, to realize that so many of them are afraid to speak or reluctant to speak on the record about their own personal experiences with sexual misconduct from other lawmakers, at the hand of other lawmakers over many, many years. But the Assembly will address this. This, of course, happens in the context of Harvey Weinstein and what's going on in the national conversation. But where does that stand as we begin the session tomorrow?
So actually, a couple weeks back, or a few weeks back at this point, the General Assembly leaders enacted a policy change that doesn't need General Assembly approval at large, that will require an annual report on the number of effectively sexual harassment reports that end up getting investigated. So right now there's not really any clarity on how often these things are reported to the staff, to the leadership staff. And so this will at the very least give us kind of a window into this world. And it's not just female legislators who this would apply to, but it's also staff who work for these legislators who are female or male, for that matter, and also
lobbyists. You can imagine the conundrum and the dilemma that a lobbyist finds herself in if, you know, a legislator is, you know, harassing her and she's got business before that legislator's committee or something. It's just an implausible, impossible situation. Yeah. Aaron Cox, I mean, is there, do you think Mike Bush and Mike Miller have embraced this? Do you think they get it when it comes to the importance of revising the processes? I mean, one of their ideas is to have a larger pool of people who can take complaints. But do you think that this has hit home with the male-run legislative leadership?
So let me answer that question this way. When the policy was changed to say we're going to do this central tracking, and there will be a report, and to do that, when they kind of updated their system, and even after last year when they, you know, said that you can be a third party can report harassment, that you don't have to be the victim, that if you witness it, if you witness somebody way outside the bounds, that you can go report that on your own. You don't need to have a victim be complicit in that process. When that revamp was done, the response from a lot of advocates was, that's really not enough. The idea that the identities of lawmakers who have been found of wrongdoing may never come to light, not just it would be confidential when there was an allegation, but if an allegation was sustained, that those people's identities would not necessarily be public. And these are people who, on the job being paid by taxpayers, behaved in a way that is far outside socially accepted conduct. The response was, this is just not enough. So to the extent and whether or not the leadership of the General Assembly is taking this seriously, they're definitely taking it seriously. They're definitely, you know, attempting to make a change. Whether or not that's sufficient, according to a lot of the people who are watching this process from afar, they're skeptical that that's enough.
And I do want to add that my sense of this in talking to people is that there's just among, particularly among, as you put it, the male leaders of the General Assembly, I don't think that there is awareness of how frequent the complaints are and what the complaints look like. And I do think that report is a first step toward some acknowledgement of how widespread the problem is, not just among the leadership, but among the General Assembly writ large.
Yeah, this is not necessarily a legislative fix. It's not like they're going to need to pass a law, but they are going to need to make sure that the procedures they have in place within the body are going to be sufficient to address what is clearly a big problem in the politics business, just like it is in the entertainment business, in the media business, in the hotel business, and you name it. Aaron Cox, I want to talk about Senator Nathaniel Oaks. He is set to stand trial for corruption charges in April. The trial is scheduled to begin sometime after the session finishes this year. You've got Mike Miller and Mike Bush. You've got Cheryl Glenn of the Legislative Black Caucus. I talked to her about it and Kurt Anderson about it when they were on the show a few weeks back. At the moment, standing behind Nathaniel Oaks and saying that he's got a right to sit and be part of this session while he is under this very heavy cloud, given the fact that he has confessed to some of the crimes that he's been convicted of, although he has pled not guilty to the charges. What's the leadership's position on Senator Oaks?
Well, just as we have been sitting here talking, Mike Miller has announced that he would refer Oaks for an ethics investigation. When we spoke to him last week before this new affidavit came out in the case, Miller's position was, well, what I think legally and what I think morally are two different things, whether or not I think he should leave the chamber. He says Oaks has told leadership that he thinks he will be vindicated at trial, that he is innocent, and he's not, because of that, you know, he's not going to step down out of his seat. The documents were filed in court on Friday by the FBI show that Oaks did confess to elements of what he's being charged with, and that is now part of the court record, that is now part of the public record, and so that has shifted the debate a little bit. So as we were speaking, Mike Miller has told reporters that he thinks, you know, that this is something the ethics, you know, committee should look into. An ethics investigation is a precursor to taking any sort of action against a senator for reasons that, you know, I think we can all appreciate. It is not easy to just kick a sitting senator out of office. There's a process. There are things that have to be followed. And so what Mike Miller essentially did today is kind of take a step further than where he was last week, saying it's not up to me. It's up to the courts to say, you know what? There is enough in these federal filings to warrant an ethics investigation right now, and I'm going to refer one to the committee.
In your piece that you wrote about this a day or two ago, Mr. Oaks's lawyer referred to it as a dragnet, that this case was part of a large dragnet that looked into all sorts of legislators at the Baltimore City Council level, the state legislature level. In this affidavit, evidently, it came to light that one of the people who worked, I guess, in the bail bonds industry had paid not only Nathaniel Oaks, but another undisclosed elected official thousands of dollars. Is there any hint and any understanding as to who that other elected official might be?
You know, we have some theories. Everybody around here kind of has a short list. There's a big topic of gossip in Annapolis. Nobody that I'm aware of has narrowed it down to one specific lawmaker, but that's certainly something that the Baltimore Senate's reporting on and following up on. And if we figure out who it might be, we'll sure tell everybody.
And Rachel Bay, anything in particular, we got just a few seconds here to finish up, anything in particular that you're going to be tracking down in these first couple of weeks?
So I think the tax issue is going to be a major one. We're obviously going to have a couple of veto overrides. There's also, in addition to sick leave, the bill removing criminal history from Maryland college applications. So that's also something we might see a veto override of initially. There are many contentious issues that will likely be at the fore this year.
Yeah, well, you are both going to be in the thick of it for the next 90 days, and we look forward to checking in with you frequently between now and the end of session to see how things are going. Rachel Bay, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And Aaron Cox, it's always a pleasure to speak with you as well, and break a leg this session. Enjoy it.
Thanks so much. Great to be on.
Rachel Bay covers state politics for WIPR. Aaron Cox is the Baltimore Sun's State House Bureau Chief. We've got links to some of their reporting from Annapolis on our website, wypr.org/ midday. That's it for us today. Coming up on the program tomorrow, it's Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. We'll be joined by Dan Ariely from the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University. It's a real thing, the Center for Advanced Hindsight. I am not kidding you. He's got ideas about weight loss that you may find interesting. Plus, Monica will give us an update on the newest genetically modified food. So speaking of food, I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. They serve coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Out of the Blocks is up next after a break for news at the top of the hour. We will be back with you tomorrow at noon. Have a great day.